This is a Triple J podcast.
Every billionaire is a douchebag.
Parliament is a sick place.
I thought, oh my God, I might be an alcoholic. Obviously, I'm an inadequate guest.
No, that's not what I'm saying.
Who's the Prime Minister?
Days of harrowing evidence, young Jewish Australians describing harassment, abuse while studying, while working, even at home. A Royal Commission into Anti-Semitism has been having hearings over more than a week. So what have we heard so far? G'day, it's Dave Marchese with you for Hack. Coming up, we're going to hear some of that testimony from Jewish Australians and talk about what they want to see come out of this big inquiry.
And I really think that this is it's a turning point. It's a national reckoning where we draw a line in the sand.
Yeah, later we're going to be talking about another story, which is scientists in the US dying or going missing. You might have been hearing about this on social media, a lot of conspiracy theories circling. So are these cases actually linked or is this a coincidence? We'll get into that. First though,
Hack.
Australia now has the highest gambling losses per person of any country in the world.
On Triple J.
Yeah, let's start with some breaking news this afternoon on gambling reform. Because for years, there's been pressure on the government to release its response to a landmark inquiry into gambling, the Murphy Report. Now, we've spoken a bit about this on Hack over the past few years. You've heard from young Aussies, some still battling to break free from gambling addiction, others who've lost loved ones. And they've all called for stronger action against gambling harms. Now, earlier this year, the Prime Minister signalled he wasn't going to be introducing a full ban on gambling advertising, even though this landmark inquiry called for that. But the government has finally released its response to the inquiry, so we know what its plans are. But many are questioning the timing today. Budget day. While journalists in Canberra are flat out covering another big story. Look, let's get into this more now with Independent MP Kate Chaney. She was part of the Murphy inquiry. Kate Chaney, thank you so much for joining us.
No worries.
The government tabling this response to the Murphy report on the day of the budget lockup, when a lot of journalists are locked away and you know, trying to pump out all of the reporting on the budget. What do you make of that?
Oh, look, it's no accident, and it makes me really, really mad. We've waited for 1,051 days for this response, and now they've literally tabled it on the day when every journalist is locked in a room thinking about something else. So this is not what you do if you're proud of the reform package that you're putting forward.
We've heard from the Prime Minister already earlier this year about what was going to be in this response. We knew that there would be no overall ban on gambling advertising. We're also finding out that, you know, there's also not going to be a national online gambling regulator, which was one of the key recommendations. What do you make of that?
It's so disappointing. We need a national regulator because at the moment gambling is regulated through this Swiss cheese arrangement all over the country. We heard this week that Ladbrokes breached the bet stop laws 500 times and ACMA, the regulator, couldn't even impose a penalty. The other regulator's in the Northern Territory and it's a cowboy outfit that's just full of conflict of interest. So we desperately need a national regulator here and the government's just completely ignoring that recommendation along with a whole lot of others.
There have been some politicians like you, Independent Senator David Pocock, others who have been calling for the release of this response to the Murphy inquiry. Also a lot of people who gave evidence to the inquiry, people who had personal experiences of gambling. How are they feeling? Like, have you been in touch with any of these people?
Look, I have been in touch with them. I sat on the committee that did this inquiry and we heard 45 hours of evidence about the impact of gambling. Some of it was really harrowing and people were really brave and, you know, fronted up and presented and talked, you know, told their stories to the committee. And really the response that we've got from the government, I think, does not respect the evidence that those people provided. Often in a response to a committee inquiry, it'll go through recommendation by recommendation and say whether the government accepts it in full or in principle or notes it. This one, it just says the government notes all the recommendations. So I don't think it's really doing justice to the level of harm in the country that's caused by gambling and the normalisation of gambling as part of sport, I don't think it also respects the time that people put into making submissions or giving evidence to that inquiry.
What do you think the late Peter Murphy would think of this response?
Peter was an amazing woman, and it was the first parliamentary inquiry I sat on, and I thought they were all going to be like that, but it turned out it was a particularly good one where she managed to get unanimous agreement on the 31 recommendations from people from across the political spectrum, and she was pretty passionate about gambling reform, so I think she'd be pretty disappointed. But obviously, I can't speak for her. But I've certainly been thinking about her when I've been pushing the Prime Minister to actually listen to the Australian public and do what needs to be done and phase out gambling ads like we did with tobacco ads a generation ago.
And just finally, Kate Chaney, do you think this is it now for this government in terms of reforms to gambling, that's the last we'll hear of it?
No way, because it can't be. New polling came out today that showed that 76% of Australians want to see a ban on gambling ads, and that includes more than 4 out of 5 Labor voters. So I don't think Labor, the Prime Minister's heard the end of this. I think there are lots of people on his backbench as well as in the crossbench and all through the community who think that the government should actually be brave here and take a step that could be part of this Prime Minister's legacy. And phase out those ads and make sure that we're actually regulating this industry. What we've got is a regulation package that the gambling industry will be stoked about because it focuses on offshore illegal gambling sites. So, you know, we're not the problem, they're the problem. And it also reinforces the personal responsibility narrative that says, this isn't a public health issue, this is your problem. So we'll raise awareness about it. And we might have some more financial counselling, but ultimately it's up to you to not have a gambling addiction. So I think it's so disappointing, but they haven't heard the last of it.
Independent MP Kate Chaney, really appreciate your time.
Thanks so much.
And hearing from a lot of you, someone saying, look, I worked with a friend who struggled with gambling and successfully quit for 2 months. I was there when a betting company called him and said, we notice you haven't been active in a while. We're running a program where we'll match you bet for bet, meaning you double the prize for next week. How is this possible? That person saying. Another person on the text line, absolutely disgusting. This was dropped on budget day. And someone else just saying, get gambling advertising off TV.
Hack. The capital gains tax reform is back in the spotlight and there's a lot of noise around what these changes could mean.
On Triple J.
Yeah, as you've been hearing, it is budget day, which means a lot of the journalists, creators that maybe you follow locked away all day for the budget lockup, poring over the government's plans on how it's going to spend taxpayers' money over the next few years, where it's going to be making savings. We're going to have the full budget wrap up on Hack tomorrow. And there are some things, though, that we know about, we found out about early, and we've been talking about some of those, like changes to taxes, specifically around negative gearing and capital gains tax. So what are these policies, and will changing them actually make houses more affordable for you? Well, Hack political reporter Shalala Madora has been looking into it.
Young people, they really care at the moment about how the government tackles the big challenges that Australia faces.
Matt Bowes from the Grattan Institute reckons young people are becoming more engaged on a topic they normally don't care much about.
They can see that the decisions the government makes about taxes and spending, they may sound far away when you're a young person, but the fact is that they could shape your life outcomes.
And that's especially true in the housing market, where young people are increasingly locked out of owning their own homes.
For a long period of time, young people have tried to save for a home. Another year has passed since the election and not enough has changed.
Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has defended making possible changes to tax arrangements that drive investment in housing, even though making those changes would mean breaking an election promise.
Government is about making the right decisions for the right reasons for the times that you are in. And if we do change our position on any policy, we will explain why it is that is occurring.
The budget is expected to include changes to negative gearing and capital gains tax, or as some people call it, CGT. Not sure what those are? Don't worry. AMP's Deputy Chief Economist Deanna Messina's got you.
Negative gearing is where the cost of owning an investment is more than the income that the investment generates. You're using the loss that you have made on that asset to then reduce your personal income taxation.
While we may think of negative gearing in relation to housing, it actually applies to all investments. So does the capital gains tax.
The capital gains tax comes in when you sell that asset. For example, if you bought a house worth $10 and you sell it 5 years later, it's worth $100, you would have to pay tax on that $90.
At the moment, there's a 50% discount on the tax if you hold an asset for more than 12 months before selling. Importantly, though, in the housing context, it only applies to investment properties.
If you wanted to sell your principal place of residence, you wouldn't have to pay the capital gains tax on that.
Whatever changes are made, they're unlikely to affect people who already have investment properties.
What they usually do is called grandfathering. So if you've already purchased the asset, these changes do not apply to you.
The big question is, will any of this make homes cheaper?
Investors make up an important share of the property market, but it's still only about a third of properties that are owned by investors.
Matt Bowes says it's unlikely that changes to negative gearing or the CGT will significantly lower demand.
Those investors are probably going to be replaced by other homeowners who are looking to get into the market.
And demand is what's driving prices.
We estimate that winding back negative gearing and the capital gains tax concessions would probably reduce property prices in the order of 1%. So it's a pretty small effect.
Matt reckons it's still worth making the changes.
These tax concessions have really important impacts for tax equity in Australia because they're concessions that go to generally the wealthiest Australians. That really makes the case for reform pretty clear, even before we start thinking about the impacts on the housing market.
You're listening to Hack on Triple J.
Shalala Medora reporting there. And yeah, reminder, full budget wrap-up tomorrow on Hack. We're going to have all the analysis for you and we're going to be joined by some commentators that you might know. Conrad Benjamin from Punters Politics, Hannah Ferguson as well from Cheek Media. Hannah in the lockup, so he's going to have all the analysis for you. Going to be able to talk about what is in this budget for young Australians and what is not.
Hack. Growing up within Australia, unfortunately, we were always aware of the presence of anti-Semitism, but it did not play such a massive role in our lives that it does now.
On Triple J.
People scared of going out, kids getting abused at school, even bullied while gaming. The Royal Commission into Anti-Semitism and Social Cohesion, which was announced in the wake of the Bondi Beach terrorist attack, has been going for more than a week now, more than a week of public hearings. It's heard from relatives of people killed in the attack, teenagers, students and experts in a bid to try to understand the circumstances that led up to Bondi Beach and the spread of anti-Semitism in Australia that came before it. Alice Angeloni with this update of what the inquiry has heard so far.
A man pointed at my Star of David necklace and called me an effing terrorist.
All sorts of racial slurs, among them Dirty Jew, started doing the Nazi salute.
It's so painful, even if you weren't there, because the reality is they came to kill us. We just weren't there.
The Royal Commission on Anti-Semitism and Social Cohesion has been going for more than a week now, with the first block of hearings taking place in Sydney. So far, the Commission has heard from teachers, healthcare workers, students and Holocaust survivors who have detailed their real-life experiences of anti-Semitism.
I felt as though anti-Semitism was being allowed to come into the open.
Shayna Gotnick was the first person to give evidence last Monday.
Bondi holds many complicated and conflicting feelings for me currently. It was somewhere where my parents had started their history together.
Her father was one of 15 people killed in the shooting at a Hanukkah celebration at Bondi Beach last year.
He was deeply proud to have moved to Australia and been an Australian citizen and grateful for a nation that welcomed Jews when so many others turned them away at that time.
She told the commission she'd seen a rise in anti-Semitism after the October 7 terror attacks in Israel.
All of a sudden, it was socially, morally acceptable for anti-Semitic comments to be made in public discourse.
Shayna is just one of a number of Australians who have given evidence in the past 10 days. 22-year-old Mia told the commission conversations around her share house began to shift after the October 7 attacks too.
They felt like they've been walking on eggshells in the house around me and that the house wasn't a safe space for them to have tough political conversations.
She reckons her housemates had formed an opinion without actually talking to her about Israel.
And they said that they couldn't live with me. I was sitting there distraught. I was sobbing.
Lots of witnesses have been kept anonymous to protect their identity and allow them to speak freely. Yesterday, the commission heard from a 15-year-old who was subject to anti-Semitic abuse while playing Minecraft, and creatives sharing their experiences of doxing.
Particularly in the art and creative and music world, we started just seeing a lot of hostility and animosity.
Joshua Mosher is an award-winning saxophonist and composer. He joined a WhatsApp group for other creatives experiencing anti-Semitism in the wake of the October 7 attacks. In 2024, his messages in that group were leaked to the media.
I was feeling extremely anxious, feeling like my life was starting to unravel.
Joshua told the commission the leak resulted in him being kicked out of his band and a wave of anti-Semitic threats against himself and his family.
They posted a public post denouncing me, and that was the first I heard about it.
The post was read out.
As four other individual human beings, we explicitly condemn any forms of Zionism, racism, bullying, anti-Semitism and prejudice.
But Josh felt his former bandmates didn't really understand the meaning of those words.
They say they condemn all forms of Zionism. The one I subscribe to, which is that Jews deserve a home in some part of their ancestral homeland, then how can you condemn that and anti-Semitism?
Josh's band later apologised to him on social media.
What starts with the Jewish community doesn't end with the Jewish community.
The special envoy to combat anti-Semitism, Gillian Siegel, was called before the commission last week. She says anti-Semitism is like a virus.
It undermines our whole democracy. It undermines Australian values.
Gillian Siegel says Jewish people are experiencing four kinds of anti-Semitism, the fastest growing being the conflation of Jewish people with the actions of Israel.
I think that there are a lot of people who disagree with the government of Israel and with its decisions and the way it's behaved, and they conflate that way back with the Jews.
The commission will continue hearing evidence for the rest of the week, with the definition of anti-Semitism set to be debated after the Jewish Council of Australia was given leave to appear. A second block of hearings focused specifically on the circumstances surrounding the Bondi terror attack will start on May 25th.
This is Hack on Triple J.
Alice Angeloni reporting there. Look, let's get into this chat a little more now with someone who has given evidence to this Royal Commission over the past week. Tali Blicklau is CEO of the Door Foundation, which is a national group that's been set up to look at anti-Semitism in Australia. Tali, thank you very much for joining us. As I said, you have given evidence at this Royal Commission. What did you think?
Yeah, I was there yesterday giving evidence about the rise in anti-Semitism in Australia. The subject matter is challenging. It's been a really, really confronting week listening to some of the testimony, the lived experience in particular, particularly the lived experience testimony of young Australians. On one hand, it's been really confronting, but on the other, we're really grateful that Australia is listening, that we're taking this issue seriously and we're taking collective ownership of how to do better.
Yeah, how important do you think this inquiry is to get an understanding of the scale of anti-Semitism in Australia right now?
I think it's a turning point. We've seen over the last 2 years an escalation in violence culminating in the massacre at Bondi Beach in December of last year. But well before that, we saw an escalation of hateful words, both in the real world and online, incidents increasing from what started as kind of exclusion and bullying through to property damage and then increasing violence over time. And I really think that this is, it's a turning point. It's a national reckoning where we draw a line in the sand.
There was some research that was outlined at the Royal Commission today from the National Council of Jewish Women of Australia, which found 80% of Jewish women in Australia have experienced anti-Semitism personally or against an immediate family member. I mean, does that surprise you?
It doesn't surprise me as a Jewish woman because that has been my reality and the reality of my friends and family and colleagues. But just because it's been normalised, it doesn't make it normal and it doesn't make it okay. And I think what's been the most disappointing when it comes to that testimony given by the National Council of Jewish Women has been that some of the perpetrators have been feminists themselves.
I mean, last week there was an interesting point in the hearings when the Commissioner Virginia Bell asked the head of the Zionist Foundation of Australia whether he could appreciate that there is a line between delegitimizing Israel and the views of some non-Jewish Australians who are critical of actions of Israel. I'm wondering, do you think that is an important discussion to have?
I think it is an important discussion to have, and I'm grateful that the Commissioner has been asking those very important questions, because what we don't want in a democratic society is the stifling of political debate. It is absolutely fair to criticise the actions of a government, whether our own or a foreign government, and that's fine. Where we cross that line is where collective blame is levelled on a group of people who really have no agency to influence the actions of another country.
Tali, there have been some within the Jewish community, the filmmaker, author Anthony Lowenstein, who's questioned whether those giving evidence at this Royal Commission reflect the breadth of Jewish opinion in Australia. I'm wondering if you agree with that.
Look, it is ultimately the Commissioner's inquiry. She is an expert. She is running a comprehensive inquiry. She has collected evidence and now, I understand it, 10,000 submissions, which certainly provides a cross-section of opinions from across society, both the Jewish community and broader society. And so I'm confident that is the case. I also should say that the sort of mainstream organisations of the Jewish community, those who represent hundreds of organisations as their constituents, are working together in order to assist the Commission in the best way that we can.
Tali, what do you hope comes out of this Royal Commission?
I hope the outcome is a safer Australia. This is not just about the Jewish community. This is about a safer, more inclusive and more tolerant Australia for everyone. You know, we really need to see outcomes that are going to protect everyone.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with us today. I appreciate your time. Tali Blickblau from the Door Foundation, thanks for coming on Hack.
Thanks for having me.
And we got a lot of messages coming through, someone saying, you know, we really need this Royal Commission. Another person, though, saying, I've never seen a Royal Commission achieve anything significant. And someone else saying, the difficulty is when criticism of Israel is labelled as anti-Semitism when it isn't. I think it invalidates Jewish people's experiences with genuine anti-Semitism. Look, we're going to keep going and we'll keep checking in on that Royal Commission as it continues.
Hack. Members of Congress are set to take on a deepening mystery after at least 10 American scientists died or disappeared.
On Triple J.
I don't know if you've seen anything about this. It is like the plot of a film about a dozen scientists in the US either disappearing or dying. Were they enemies of the state? Could UFOs be involved? The conspiracy theories have been wild over the past few weeks. Even the US President, Donald Trump, has weighed in on this. And this story doesn't seem to be going away. So what is happening? Are these cases linked? And what could be behind it? Well, let's ask someone who has been taking a close look at all of this. His name is Dan Adler, and he's a writer for Vanity Fair in New York. He joins us now. Dan, thank you very much for joining us on Hack. When did you decide you wanted to start looking into this story of the missing scientists?
So this was a story that had been percolating online and on social media for some amount of time. The UFO community, the disclosure community, as they're sometimes called, is very active. There are sort of like media personalities, and a lot of that commentary has sort of spilled into maybe not what one would consider mainstream media here in the U.S., but maybe an alternative mainstream, the sort of Joe Rogans of the world. So I've been watching this story sort of gain steam. And it crossed over, I want to say, in maybe March or April. The American tabloids and the international tabloids started picking it up. And it all sort of reached a crescendo in the White House press briefing room when Carolyn Leavitt was asked about it. And she said, the administration is looking into it. This is something the Trump administration often does. It says it's looking into sort of far-fetched theories. So when it hit that point, when it became sort of political news, I wanted to take a closer look and sort of peek under the hood and see if there was anything to this.
Well, before we get to the answer, what do we know about the people who have gone missing or who have died?
Yeah, the theory is that some amount of scientists over the past 2 to 3 years that they've either gone missing or been killed, and that it varies case to case. And probably the two most famous cases are a man named William McCasland, who worked at a laboratory in New Mexico that is thought by UFO theorists to be the site of the famous Roswell crash. It's thought that, you know, he had access to classified materials related to extraterrestrials. And another sort of standout case is the shooting at Brown University last year. The shooter in that case also killed a physicist at MIT. And, as to the best of my knowledge and to the best of any knowledge that I've seen, that physicist did not have any connection to classified programs, nuclear weapons, UFOs, anything like that. But within the framing of this kind of theory, he began to take on a sort of, almost like an urban legend character, like, oh, maybe this guy knew something and that's why he was killed.
Have we heard much from, like, the families of the people who've gone missing?
So part of the difficulty is that I think a lot of people are understandably private about their family members going missing or dying, and maybe don't want to deal with reporters or give public statements. That said, the most high-profile disappearance and the most high-profile public comments about any of these scientists was the wife of William McCasland, who was the man who worked at the New Mexico laboratory. She said, normal woman with a Facebook page. She just wrote on her Facebook page, "I've been seeing the online speculation. You know, my husband, he's dealing with some difficulties." Again, probably understandably didn't get into all the details, but she just made very clear in her statement that she really didn't think that her husband had anything to do with UFOs.
Has it surprised you just how much this has taken off? Because there's so much cut through with people, like people who aren't engaged in, news normally are really leaning into this conspiracy theory and spreading it.
Yeah, am I surprised? Yes and no. I mean, I do think it's a little dispiriting that as the way you and I are talking about it right now, if you sort of look under the hood for a second, 2 seconds, it, as one expert told me, the mystery just sort of vanishes. You think, okay, like it's obviously sad that 11, 13 people died or went missing in some period of time. But if you look at the stats, that's out of like maybe 700,000 people. It's not that noteworthy in a macro sense. It's surprising in that sense, I would say, but I would say it's also not surprising because, A, as I mentioned, we're living in sort of a Joe Rogan-centric media ecosystem. We have a president in the United States who really trades in conspiracy theories. So from that vantage, it makes all the sense in the world, unfortunately, that conspiracy theories can very quickly scale politically and as news.
You mentioned the White House being asked about this, the Trump administration. Donald Trump himself said that it was pretty serious stuff. How much do you think that kind of escalated this and really continued the push for this conspiracy theory to get out there?
Again, if you think of it as a plot line that someone's following, I think Trump is, above all, is a reality TV guy, right? Sort of a great entertainer. And it was not insignificant to me that as this conspiracy theory was gaining steam and he was talking about it, he appeared at a youth-centered conservative event and he said, okay, like, I know you guys love this stuff. We're going to release the UFO files.
And has Trump said that there's going to be some kind of investigation that he's looking into this?
Yes, he said that, it's also kind of a classic Trumpian gambit is like, we're looking into this and then it just sort of dissipates.
So just to be clear, Dan, if there's somebody listening now and they're wanting to know if this is more than it seems, if, there is some really hectic thing going on in secret here, you're saying these deaths, disappearances, not linked.
That's my view, that they are not linked. One thing I should also say, though, is that I have not personally undertaken an investigation of each of these deaths and disappearances. And I think there is a distinction to be drawn. William McCasland's disappearance is still not accounted for. And that's a legitimate subject of inquiry investigation. His wife gave that statement, but I'm sure she and so many others are still in need of real answers. That said, I think it also does a disservice to the people looking for those answers to tie it to this broader conspiracy around, again, UFOs, nuclear weapons, whatever you have it, because there has not been any evidence of that.
Oh, it's fascinating either way and a really good read. I really enjoyed seeing your piece in Vanity Fair. Writer Dan Adler, really appreciate your time.
Appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
And we got mixed opinions on the text line. Someone saying if Trump is acknowledging this, it's a distraction for sure, that person's saying. But another person saying, I don't know. I feel like someone didn't want disclosure from them. So it's definitely got a lot of people talking, this conspiracy theory, this story in general. Look, that is all we've got time for on Hack for now. If you are looking for a bit of budget explanation. If you're a bit overwhelmed over the next few hours with everything that's coming out over the budget and you're thinking, what does all this mean for me? We can come back to Hack tomorrow. We're going to have the full breakdown for you. Hack's reporters have been in the budget lockup, so they'll have all the details. And I'll be joined by Punters Politics and Hannah Ferguson as well to sort through all of the detail. And yeah, we'll be able to figure out what is in there and also what is not in there, which is what often gets a lot of attention. Okay, that's all for now. Hack.